Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Rachel Menes. Rachel Menes is the author of The Glad Hand of God Points Backwards, finalist for a 2015 National Jewish Book Award, and the chapbook No Silence in the Fields. She serves as the series editor for the Walt MacDonald First Book Prize in Poetry at Texas Tech University Press. Menes teaches writing at Carnegie Mellon University and is a member of AGNI's editorial staff. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me, Lauren.
Great. Can you begin by reading us some of your poems?
Yeah, absolutely. The teenage girl opens hunger's mouth. I grow a back for bearing, a tongue for preference. I want the garden green and gold and red to taste its nothing seeds. I haven't yet met the men growing gods in their bellies, already desperate for air. I don't yet see their white teeth shine. I put the world in my mouth, and soon the world flattens before me, prone. I hold the world between my hands, and the world, smiling, curls my palms into fists. First Gentile. I promise him bitterness, salt, the tastes of all my dead, gold and wax, the roots of trees. Against me he is scaffolding, linen, bicep and thigh, all newness, private liturgy of high school hunger, snow collecting on his parents' car. I've just observed Hanukkah, the consecrated fuel that burned on faith, young enough to believe in the miracle that's mine alone, a forsaken fuse and the hands that light it, the labor of soldiers and battle and cold, then the flame. He finds me in handfuls, first hair, then skin, then cries, then silence, his torso reclothed, tying his sneakers. You'd be better at this, he says, at touching so quickly, efficient and practiced, if you stopped thinking so much. But I have the worries of my great aunts, their consonant names. After he leaves, the snow melts to puddles, the engine of my mouth runs on the fumes of God. Abad with Plan B. I cannot forgive my body all its hopeful work to keep you close. It forgets how hunger looks after months left in sunlight, white left behind ring of itself, shocked ghost against the earth. Tonight my body peels its arms open like a swimmer in the waves. It puts its mouth to the brakes and drinks. In daylight, I shuffle my body to the pharmacist, your naked back warm in the bed. My body knows that water always lifts a loss to the surface. It never meets the others drying on the sand. It touches my tongue to salt and thirsts, confuses love with carry, with grow. I climb my body's morning emptiness back into bed. I reach out and touch your shoulder. I open bright for you again. Revision first. And the whole mystery lifts like a skirt, how you mistook your suffering for learning, how you took the rock between your legs as if you could make it a diamond with enough grinding, enough prayer, how you thought the summer and its swollen peaches existed as metaphor for your desire, teenage girl for whom everything in heat sanctions your appetite. How you ripped peach after peach at their crease and sucked them over the sink alone, imagined each boy watching. How did they taste? Why can't you remember? Miscarriage is like a large, hungry gull. Come to roost in our rafters, the damn thing lets loose on the foyer stairs, an indifferent assassin, a tired old intestine releasing its sins. We aren't anywhere near the Cape, I say over the hum of the refrigerator. At night, she swells to the size of the Wright brothers plane, all plumes and bones brittle like straw, an appetite like a pregnant woman's, always perched between us when we're alone in the house. So many of these creatures, beaches of them, with hearts so small and dumb and procedural. How many houses must feed them and feed them, watch them swell? Bird, I shout, and each time I name her, she grows. First draft of the mother. The creature I made has feet too soft for the ground. The creature has my feet, perhaps my feet once too soft for the ground, a puzzle my mother solved or grew stronger on my weakness, lifting me up, up. I feed this creature and she grows. You and I had known the secret of this simple, impossible work all along. We lift her and lift her, and she sings somewhere above us, gravity and what saves us from gravity. She survives, and we feed on her survival, this sour mouth and this hot skin, this hoarder of our light.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Rachel Menies. Rachel, one thing that I really love about your work is that it invokes these, sort of abstract emotions like desire and longing and even regret sometimes. And those aren't always pretty things. But what attracts you to write about that kind of subject matter? Or even if that's what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I live there in my work pretty prominently. And I believe in talking about, especially from a woman's perspective, the difficulties in relationships or with our bodies that we face as women in particular as an act of witness, and that witnessing isn't always witnessing that which we find beautiful or easy in our lives, but also where places where we might find friction or struggle. And the poems I just read in particular point to the struggles of being a young woman, being a teenage girl, the changes in the body, the changes, the things you experience and then have to sort of synthesize through that body and through your emotions, the deep desires that come with coming of age and not knowing what to do with them. They're multidirectional. They don't make sense. They're often unrequited. They're sometimes dangerous and take us to dangerous places. And I think that speaking about those honestly, or at least attempting to find versions of that honesty or versions of that truth is work that I very much want to do in my poetry.
That's interesting. So do you see the speaker of the poems as a witness?
Yes, I definitely do. I think it depends certainly maybe on the poem or the set of poems.
Right.
But I absolutely think that the speakers in my work are working to testify about their experience in some way or another, or at least to sort of offer the places where that difficulty emerges, and that it's in those difficulties there is both great joy and great danger. I definitely do see the role of the speakers in my work as holding that witness and putting forth that witness.
So would you say there's more of a, when the witness is a speaker, there's more of a responsibility than just an observer, and maybe what that responsibility might be?
Yeah, that I think about that a lot in my new work, especially because of the feeling sometimes that the greater world doesn't know what it's like to be a woman. And we see this played out in politics all the time, that that the greater world is either actively working against ourselves and sort of giving our, you know, having a sort of sense of ourselves in terms of equality, but also in terms of experience. When you see legislatures pass that work to censor or make more difficult or deny access to any number of things, I do think for me, because I'm trying to talk about those experiences, I do feel a sense of responsibility in my work to that. I don't know about how that translates for other writers, and I don't want to suggest that we are obligated to have our speakers testify or speak certain truths. For me, though, it feels very important.
Right. I mean, Everybody has their own objective when they're writing, but I would think that it would make it a little more challenging if I felt that kind of responsibility.
Yeah.
And what kind of pressure that might put on me. Do you feel pressure?
Yeah. It feels risky. It feels scary. I feel most afraid when certain poems in this vein are published, especially also because I am a woman, my speakers are women. Am I taking on, you know, by speaking as a woman, am I speaking for? I want to always be careful not to speak for or over, but at the same time, to take on difficult subjects. But it does feel risky, and it feels sometimes frightening.
Right. But that's the good stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
So you have this, your poems sort of have a preoccupation with body and body imagery. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that is a word that after I finish early drafts, we'll notice everywhere. Body, textures, sensory details, deep physicality. It's where I live. It's where I feel very hyper aware of bodily experience in my life. And I don't know if that what part of my experience that comes from, but I know I do. I notice it everywhere in my work, and I am just sort of pulling that thread until there's nothing left. I so far haven't yet exhausted the whatever nearly infinite spool this feeling about body and pleasure and touch and fear around that, but also just the sort of that tentative space between seeking pleasure but understanding the risks of putting your literal body out there.
And the consequences.
Yes, exactly.
That may come. And also in that miscarriage poem, I really love the sounds that you're working with. So sound very important to you in your work, or is that something that comes in drafting or revision? How does that work?
Yeah, it mostly comes for me in revision. I find that I'm a pretty aggressive reviser. I talk about this a lot with my students who I remember when I was a younger writer, a newer writer, my third draft, I'd think I'm done. This is as good as it's going to get. And I probably go through 15 or 20 drafts of a poem now before I think it's finished, if not more. And I find that a lot of those later moments when I'm being really deliberate and careful about word choice and line break, that's when sounds really pop for me. Whereas in the beginning, sometimes they feel more like happy accidents. And other times, they're more deliberate. But I think I focus most on image and word and metaphor in the beginning. And then as they grow, thinking about sound, I'm thinking about form. I don't often write in prescribed forms, so I'm not that. If that happens, sometimes I'll think, "Oh, this is a sonnet. The miscarriage poem is a sonnet." I didn't realize that until maybe halfway through, when I thought, "There's this turn at the end, and I'm circling around 14 lines," and so it sort of organically happens. But very rarely do I set out and think, "I'm going to write a Sestina," or "I'm going to write a Villanelle," which I don't think I've actually ever done successfully. So, yeah.
I think a lot of that happens as students, you know, you're told to write that form, so you try it out. But that's interesting. Can you read some more poems?
Yeah, absolutely. The next one I'm going to read, there's two words in Russian. Matryoshka, those are the Matryoshka dolls, the nesting dolls, the famous nesting dolls. And then Gorod means city, and that comes later in the poem. In Russia, a Russian woman is just a woman. The largest nesting doll, the peddler says, must always be a woman. My aunt, who owns 100 dolls, agrees. Only a woman, she says, can crack at the same seam 1,000 times and keep that smile. My aunt is pregnant, and I palm her with one curious hand, my new Matryoshka grinning in my other. If we are to be women, she says, if, her English slow, and I think she means something else. Since we are women, the long night, the dolls on the mantle make sense. The eyes of my growing girl cousin, like the dolls inside the dolls inside the woman, see the plain unpainted wood, see through the darkness the slightly larger beams and sanded arcs that hold up the freezing Gorod. My aunt sings to my cousin in Russian each night before bed, the syllables sounding something like, soon I will understand you. I already understand. Going back to Thera, another just two tiny place details here. Thera and Ia are both on the island of Santorini in Greece. So this is set in Greece. Going back to Thera. On our hike between Thera and Ia, the gods sit at our backs and cover our bare shoulders in light. Married only weeks, we reached for each other's hands to cross the sharpest, most treacherous rocks, the sea waving soft, a dead drop down. Married only weeks, I let you climb the caldera ahead of me. I didn't know then how to tell between latent and lost, how I'd leave my suffering asleep under your curious feet. You scrabble up the volcano's teeth, pointing in the distance to the stone city twisting around its cliff, all white against the island's reddened ash, its aquamarine sea. Today, I drive alone in Pittsburgh down its busiest gray avenues, its stone church steeples thrusting high, walls ringed with smog and grit. The gods must be in Thera still, giving flight to the newest in love, letting them summit those black-stoned jaws together without consequence or history, all lightness, their mouths wet, still drinking from the lie. Elegy with a tack dog. And the loss takes your neck in its teeth and splits the skin. And the loss shakes and shakes you, leaves your spent body on the pavement. And the loss returns quietly as if to forgive you, his fountain pens in the chipped clay mug, his bourbon softened with water. And the loss finds you months later, blissful until you see, on vacation in San Francisco. The loss stalks the palm-lined hills beside you as penance for your happiness. And the loss bares its teeth, and the loss gnaws the window latch. And the loss takes your neck in its teeth and splits the skin. And the loss shakes and shakes you, leaves your spent body on the pavement. And today, the sky decides to cover you in snow instead of rain, the new year begun without your permission. Those pens still splayed in the chipped clay mug, the bourbon closing your eyes. I begin a letter and only write first lines. I am the hound running in his sleep, barking at the mountain almost crested, entirely a dream. I am the body of the man I once loved, curling to the south-facing window in the bed upstairs, warming the negative space between himself and nothing. As I go, I take with me only what I can lift. Hamilton's mythology, the dog's untethered leash. One piece of paper with his right slanting script, I love you, bear. Look at how much I loved him, how the light in my body wanes from the other side of the closing door. Deer, which I mistook for bear, the mouth, which opens only to teeth. In this new light, I see only my reflection in the window. I should be afraid. But instead, I sharpen the pencil.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Rachel Menes. So I'm really interested in that elegy poem where you're sort of personifying loss. Can you talk a little bit about where that poem came from or the inspiration for that?
Yeah. So this is a great story because it's a Pittsburgh poet story. A couple of years ago now, I think it was 2 years ago, was a teacher in the Young Writers Institute with many wonderful writers, but two wonderful poets in particular, both who live in Pittsburgh, Tamika Cage Conley and Jill Corey. And one of the cool things about Young Writers, and these were high schoolers that we were working with, was we got to sit in on each other's classes when we weren't teaching. And Jill was teaching a class on anaphora. So I brought my notebook and I sat in the back, and Jill taught this totally amazing class on anaphora, and the students were super into it. And on the flip side, I had just friends of ours who had lost their dog to another dog in a sort of one of those unfortunate dog-on-dog crime incidents. And I have a dog and was sort of just had felt such tremendous grief of what they were going through. And I was sitting there, and I was thinking about, how do you write a poem about a dog? It's sort of like one of the things I've struggled with. How do you write a poem about a baby? There's these sort of loaded, maybe sentimental things we love uncomplicatedly sometimes, or when we want to talk about how we love them complicatedly, it becomes very difficult. And so I thought, well, one way I'm going to do this, I'm just going to try to write over and over, right, to use the anaphora that Jill was laying down for us, and just see to try to talk to the dog a little bit, or imagine the dog is something else and not write a poem about a dog, but imagine the dog is a vehicle for something else instead of it being the subject of the poem. And a very, very rough version of maybe 7 or 8 of those lines emerged in the Cathedral of Learning that afternoon. And maybe a year or so later, I finally felt like I had a draft. But it started just writing along with our, you know, with our students and trying to sort of give myself the challenge of taking on grief without writing straight into it and thinking, like, what if the poem wasn't about a dog, but the dog were this the sort of monster of loss, and it wouldn't leave you alone, and it followed you everywhere. And even when you thought you had let it go, it popped up a year later when you were somewhere else and having fun. So I found then that I had to let go of the original place I'd started the poem, which was, I kind of want to write a poem about my friend's dog. But it seems that it in taking on its own life, it found its footing.
So do you put a lot of thought into a poem before you write it?
It depends. Now, in this case, I haven't been in the classroom in a while as a student, and that right. there I was, right? So in that case, I thought, well, I kind of have an assignment, and I have mm-hmm. this preoccupation. So in that case, it was pretty deliberate. For the most part, it almost is organic. Almost always, I should say, is organic. I'll be, you know, driving down the street, and I'll sit down, and I'll write down a line that's been bouncing around in my head. Or occasionally, if I'm stuck, I'll read other poets that I love and sort of get the, like, maybe do a sort of informal imitation. When I get later in a project, which is where I found myself in the last 6 months, when I'm working on a manuscript and I think, okay, I see some holes, then I will be really deliberate. I think this section is missing a couple of poems and I need to write those poems. Mm-hmm. But that only happens if I'm working on something particular. Otherwise, I tend not to give myself assignments. Yeah.
I really also like your titles.
Oh, thanks.
So that's, you know, a major important piece of a poem. So how did those come about? Do you notice a pattern? Or?
They're very difficult for me. I struggle a lot in picking titles, and I often change them with great frequency to the point where I have noticed when I make lists of poems, like for a grant or something like that, when I think, where have I published poems and what are they? Half the time they've changed since they've been in a journal, and I don't even recognize them by title. I like playing with longer titles. I like the sort of freedom of you get that unbroken line with a title that you don't always get in a poem. And my poems tend to be more lyric, so I have a lot of short broken lines. And sometimes it's nice to have the contrast of I have like I begin a letter and only write first lines, and in Russia, a Russian woman is just a woman, to have the longer titles against some of the shorter line mm-hmm. poems.
Yeah, that's a nice juxtaposition. Oh, it's interesting.
Yeah, it feels like a chance to build some contrast. I think the hardest poems to title and keep as titles are the one word mm-hmm. titles. That feels like a really difficult challenge.
Yeah, that is tough. So the titles come after the poem sometimes?
Almost always, or during. Sometimes I'll think, oh, that line, maybe that line is the title. Rarely do I start with a title, mm-hmm. keep it, and never change it. And I would say the only exception I can think of out of ones I've read here would be Elegy with Attack Dog, because I was starting with this thought of I want to write a poem about this sort of idea. But for the most part, they come somewhere to the middle, to the end mm-hmm. of the first draft.
And sometimes that kind of stuff changes. Mm-hmm. Like when I was in graduate school, I had to have a title or I couldn't write a poem. And now I can't do that anymore. So mm-hmm. I find that, you know, things change. And it's interesting to watch those patterns develop as we grow.
Absolutely.
Can you read some more poems?
Yeah, absolutely. Daughter. Weigh your mother's mood at the kitchen sink after her morning shower. At night, when her head sinks below the open newspaper and she briefly closes her eyes. Form the first important word you want to tell her in your mouth, he. Feel it dry your tongue to bone. Evaluate your nakedness in the bathroom mirror and search for signs of change. Again, he. Again, the blunt, dead mouth. Awaken each morning exiled on the bleak new planet of this word. Hear your mother downstairs cracking eggs on a metal bowl's lip, grinding beans for coffee. Hear her humming. Briefly wonder if your mother feels pleasure the way you do. Picture her arms tanned and freckled at 17, reaching for the open mouth of a boy. See instead your own back shoved against the gear shift, his hands struggling to lift your hips away from the console, pushing into you. Forget your own existence, proves her desires. My oldest girl, how badly we wanted you, she'd sung to you each night before sleep. Tell her on your birthday, in the middle of a snowstorm, while parked in her driveway, while your sisters and your father sit in your warm house, lighting 46 small white candles on a cake your mother made for herself that afternoon. Keep one hand on the passenger door handle the entire time you speak. Never consider that each of your mother's future birthdays will bring with it this one cold memory. You bent over your growing body, rocking in the passenger seat, mumbling, "He, he, he." Hear her whisper, "My oldest girl, my oldest girl." Watch the snow consume the windshield until neither of you can see. Variation on marriage is work. Each night, she puts a penny in a bucket that reads, "He loves you a little less than yesterday." And when it finally overflows, she scatters each copper flash to the carpet, then gathers their weight in her cupping hands. She swallows one coin at a time until her bronzed heart clatters. He tosses in his sleep, but her new heart doesn't wake him. Now the floorboards bend from her as she walks the unlit hallway. Now there's nothing her shining body will not buy. The Jewish woman remembers Deuteronomy 6:6-9. We cry for God in worship, later in bed, witness to the power of giving up our power. Outside the wind crying for God, outside in the fit of rain, a God just forming. Our bodies naked before men are God, as sure as the force that pushes men toward and toward us. What they search for is a noise in the earth, like God growing crops, still saving room enough for the cemeteries. The lungs expand with our God, God in the scream, also the moan, in the splitting of wood and the spilling of blood, the slaughtered bull and the dismounted horse. God of the summoning, curling finger, the broken limb and its setting right. God in the remembering and the forgetting, the sheepskin paper and the pulp. The words we can recite, they're loosening as we walk to our end. God that keeps our eyes reading. God in the hands that close the book, remove the spectacles, and turn off the light. God in our night, which never can stay night. Matriarch. Sarah had Rebecca, had Leah and Rachel, had precedent, had sand, had order, had opposition, had energy, had mourning, had parchment and ink, had commentary, had liturgy, had fire, had goats for the altar, had the longest dresses and the longest skirts, had offspring, had offspring, had offspring, had no use for sarcasm, but lived thick with God's ironies, had the text of all stories to read to their children at nightfall, had the maps of every creature quartered to keep them faithful, had the blessings of a city more powerful and impulsive, had the love of the men who have loved me or not loved me, had the hearts of the bodies we stand on tall as arcs, had the shawl to wrap around my bare and sloping shoulders, had the soil to force into my fists and turn my body west.
Thank you, Rachel. That was really great.
Yeah, thanks so much.
It was great having you here. The poetry of Rachel Menes. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.